one.
No, I got it rather open in week one because there's more total practice involved to that. Yeah. But
take what you can get.
Yeah, take what you can get.
Hello and welcome to the Around the Nation podcast for the week of Monday, September 13th. I'm Pat Coleman.
And I'm Keith McMillan.
And we're running down the end of week two and previewing week three of the 2010 Division III football season. As you heard Larry Karras talk about in our intro, if you open in week one, you end up with more practice time. If you're one of those teams that didn't open until this weekend, Mount Union was one of them, and there were many others, some of whom we'll talk about in this podcast. You're getting a late start, but welcome to the party. We're glad you're here. Week two for us was one of those weeks where the server got overloaded and we had too much traffic to handle. Hopefully, the last week we ever have to deal with that, I can voice that off on somebody else's problem as soon as the new site launches. But why don't we jump right out of the gate with the number two team in the country, last year's national runner-up, making their debut. And for Mount Union, Keith, it's a pretty young team. They started five sophomores on each side of the ball, just a total of seven seniors. People, of course, remember the name Cecil Schwartz and Kyle Miller, Lambert Budzinski and Sam Kershaw on the defensive side, but there's a lot of new faces, and obviously I'm the one who was there, but I know you can tell just from looking at the score that it was not maybe the typical Mount Union performance.
Yeah, and it's tough. Over the years, we've gotten accustomed to Mount Union winning handily, winning going away. And it's that's not always going to be the case for them, especially when you talk about them starting as many young players as they have. You know, they're human like anybody else, and the fewer years guys have been in the program and the less game experience that they have, you know, playing JV or practice experience or you know, having a role, being a role player on the main team, you know, the longer it's going to take them to get up to speed. And then you also talk about bringing in a team from the WIAC in Wisconsin Oshkosh that you know, talent-wise, physically, probably matches up fairly well with Mount Union. And the big question going in yesterday was how is Neil Seaman going to do at quarterback? And the five touchdown passes, he certainly answered some questions with that.
Yeah, that's the one position I think where I would feel really comfortable if I were Mount Union. Neil Seaman looked very good against a team that's fairly talented, as you mentioned. Anytime you can face a team out of the WIAC, you're going to get a good battle, even if you are number one or number two team in the country. Seaman, as you mentioned, five touchdown passes. He played the entire game, 26 of 37 passing with one interception. He found Kyle Miller a lot. Kyle Miller, of course, is the big tight end. He's 6'6", 265. Cecil Schwartz had plenty of catches as well, five catches for 105. He had a reverse option pass, which he decided to tuck down, and the Oshkosh defender got a hand on him in the backfield, about 10 yards back in the backfield, and he shook him off and turned that negative 10 into a 27-yard gain. So Cecil Schwartz was impressive in all facets of the game. He had a 32-yard kickoff return. He had a 44-yard punt return and just had a great day all around. Wisconsin Oshkosh was in this game for a large portion of it. They kind of lost track of it a little bit in the second quarter. Twice Oshkosh fumbled, and once it was within their own 15-yard line, and Mount Union turned that into a quick and easy score. And you know, everybody says you can't give Mount Union an opening, and that was one where they certainly took advantage of it. Neil Seaman hit Jeremy Murray for a 13-yard touchdown pass on the very next play. It was 21-7 at that point. And then on Mount Union's next possession, they went up 28-7. It was looking like it might be a bit of a runaway at that point. But Oshkosh rallied. A big pass to Paul Coburn set up a touchdown to cut it to a two-score game before half. And Oshkosh just kind of stayed with them the rest of the game. Ended up the final 45-28. 28 points is the most that Mount Union has allowed in a regular season game in longer than my records go back on regular season games. And Oshkosh was pretty impressive. So, and that's really 2 weeks in a row now for the Titans that they've come up strong against top 10 teams.
Yeah, and I think there are some good takeaway from this game for them. You know, it's never good to lose. It's never good to give up 45 points. But when you go into to a national powerhouse and you're able to run up 436 yards, rush for 198 yards, you know, you probably feel good going back to WIAC play now, saying, hey, we got the best challenge that anybody else in the country can offer. You know, there's only one team better right now than Mountain Union, and they're further down the line on Oshkosh's schedule. And now Oshkosh has seen something at that level. So when they get into that game with Whitewater, you know, they won't be sort of blown away by the level of talent. Mountain Union, you know, just looking quickly at the numbers, they did the things that you have to do well to win football games. 8 of 14 on third down, that's 57%. That's pretty good. Seaman, we mentioned 26 of 37. That's fairly nice. And only had to punt two times. So, you know, when Mountain Union rushed for 172 yards, too. They're going to go back. I'm sure they're not going to be happy with the defensive performance. But, again, a lot of turnover, and that's the type of thing that they usually make those adjustments pretty quickly.
Yeah, on the Mountain Union running game, you know, it's an impressive total, but Zach Lemon, who was the number one guy coming into the season, averaged just under 3.5 yards a carry. So I think that, yeah, they might not be too happy with that individual performance. But Jeremy Murray looked good. He also got 13 carries for 69 yards. They also threw to him a little bit out of the backfield, including two touchdown passes. I was really hoping to see T.J. Lattimore. He's a transfer running back who played at Charleston Southern for a year, and I was really hoping to see if they'd give him a couple of carries and get a chance to see what he looks like, but he did not really get that kind of opportunity. And then on the defensive side, you know, Oshkosh made the Mountain Union defense look a little ragged. They had some room in the middle of the field. They hit on a couple of deep balls. I mentioned Paul Coburn with the big catch. Nate Wera, the quarterback for Oshkosh, broke out of the pocket, pulled the ball down, ran for 34 yards. Jeremy Roach had a big 20-yard gain early in the game at running back, and then they kind of tightened up on him a little bit. But, you know, Oshkosh just made enough big plays to keep itself in the game. And, Keith, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the youth on the defense, but also the fact that they turn over so many starters. Now, that's not all that unusual for Mountain Union. They turn over starters, in big numbers on a fairly regular basis. But I think this is now 2 years in a row where they had just four or five starters back on defense from the year before. And eventually that does catch up a little bit.
And the thing that they've been able to do in a lot of years is turn over starters to juniors and seniors, guys who have been in the program, who know the system, who have had experience in JV games. And when you're not necessarily able to do that, again, you know, when you have to turn it over a year and then again the next year, you know, it's not necessarily as easy to have guys who have been experienced and gotten a lot of the reps. You know, sometimes even if guy's been in the program, if he's not one of the ones or twos, you don't get a lot of the reps in the different packages, whether it's, you know, the blitz packages or things like that. So there are a lot of nuances that certainly come with having experience, even if it's not necessarily game experience. And, you know, we talked too about Mountain Union almost in a superhuman way because of the record that they've set basically since 1993, you know, to just the standard that they set, not necessarily the record that they set, but it's a good win for them, 45-28 over a team from, well, you know, one of the really the elite conference in Division III. In their first game, they got a good performance from their quarterback. They were, you know, pretty efficient, and they good takeaway for them, to be quite honest.
Right, not just that, but of course, Mountain Union playing its first game and Oshkosh playing its second. Mountain Union taking the long trip, 12, 13-hour bus ride, almost 600 miles. It was a good to come away with a win, and they came away with some things to be happy about, and they certainly came away with some stuff to look at on video and figure out for next week. Another team that's got to figure things out for next week and maybe for the rest of the season is Monmouth. After Alex Tanney, the quarterback, goes out with a shoulder injury very early in the game, and then, you know, the Scots lose to Grinnell, which was, I think, probably before that, unfathomable.
And certainly the upset of the week, you know, there were a lot of top 25 clashes, and there were some top 25 teams that were in trouble and were able to pull out their victories. And there's another pretty significant upset, and we'll talk a little later about St. John's and Eau Claire. But Grinnell, now a team starting off 2-0, had a new coaching staff, and maybe I should have included them in the Around the Nation about winning under a new coaching staff, because that's an eye-opening win to beat Monmouth, even with Alex Tenney, going out of the game. Because Monmouth and St. Norbert have pretty much been the class of that conference for the past several years.
Yeah, I mean, Grinnell hadn't even scored against Monmouth in the last three meetings, and to come out and win that game, again, even against Monmouth's backup quarterback. I think if you told me before the game that Alex Tanney wouldn't play, I still wouldn't picture that Grinnell would go to Monmouth and come away with a W.
And that's just, now we have to. And that's the cool thing about a new season, is everything is new. You change over coaching staff. Sometimes it's a completely fresh look, and teams don't have the book on you. They don't have lots of video on you, and they don't know the type of things that you're running. And you get a chance to catch teams off guard, maybe win a couple games, and then build that confidence.
And for Jeff Peterson, of course, I should mention that he is a former D3Football.com All-American at Grinnell as a tight end, and now in his first year as head coach, the interim coach after Max Hausse left in the offseason to go become the offensive coordinator at Austin College. Another upset, maybe not of the massive nature as some of the others we've referenced so far, but I would have to think, Keith, that Cal Lutheran going toe-to-toe with Linfield and then coming away with either. Actually, I'm not sure if I should even say toe-to-toe, because they did not look very good in the first half, and they came back and really put it to them in the second half, especially on the ground.
Yeah, fell behind 28-7 in that game, but rallied for the 47-42 victory. Finished Daniel Mosier, had a 202-yard rushing day, including a 45-yard touchdown run late in the fourth quarter and a 49-yard touchdown run late in the fourth quarter. So when it got to a point where Cal Lutheran was coming from behind, rallying, and then took the lead and actually started to pull away a little bit. At one point it was 47-35, and Linfield scored with 28 seconds left.
And then get an onside kick that a Linfield player actually came out of the pile with, but it was ruled that it was Cal Lutheran ball, and they were able to run out the clock. Keith, you and I will talk a little bit later in this podcast about how conferences stack up against each other based on what we've learned so far this season. Obviously, this is not the only game that's going to take place between the SCIAC and the Northwest Conference this year. It may not be the only meeting between these two teams this year. The fact that SCIAC's number one beats Northwest Conference's number one isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all, but it is certainly a nice feather in the cap, and it comes with perhaps some important benefits come November.
Absolutely. This possibly, if things hold together, and Linfield is still the class of that conference, and that's certainly not a given with the way Willamette has played early and the type of competition that Willamette's played. But if that holds together, and if Cal Lutheran is able to go through the SCIAC schedule and be the team, they would host that sort of, we always have the de facto West Coast elimination game, and it's almost always up in the Pacific Northwest, and that means the California teams have to travel in the first round of the playoffs. I think you have to go back to 04, maybe?
The year you
were
there.
When Occidental hosted Willamette. And that was a second place team out of the Northwest Conference that season. So we haven't really seen a scenario where the SCIAC champion has been able to host in the first round in quite some time.
Cal Lutheran improves to 1-0, and Linfield falls to 0-1 with the 47-42 victory by the Kingsmen on the West Coast yesterday or Saturday afternoon, early evening. That is that's one head-to-head matchup. We have a pair of conferences that had eight head-to-head matchups this weekend, and that's the MAC and the PAC. And for the PAC to not have its champion in this event kind of hurts the PAC's chances, because you're basically taking your top team out and moving everybody else up a spot in the pecking order all the way down the line. And, Thomas More being in the Cincinnati suburbs in Kentucky is pretty far from MAC territory. So since there are nine PAC teams and eight MAC teams, it kind of made sense for Thomas More to be left out. But the rest of the PAC didn't exactly fare very well after that.
No, it was tough sledding, as they say. You know, not only did the MAC win the majority of the games, you know, there was only two PAC teams that won, but you know, some of them weren't that impressive. They weren't, you know, the way they matched this up, Pat, as you mentioned, they took the teams one through eight in the MAC, first place, and they matched it up with the corresponding team in the PAC, taking Thomas More out of the mix. And Thomas More happened to be first, so that means Del Valle plays Washington Jefferson. You know, class of that conference for the past several years. You know, the old joke was it was the President's Conference, W&J. The mascot is the President's, and it was there. It was their athletic conference for quite some time. Yesterday, though, or Saturday, it wasn't a very good day for Washington Jefferson football on the whole. Facing number 10, Del Valle, gave up 466 yards and only gained 67 yards, 27 first downs to 5. It's pretty indicative of a fairly thorough domination on the Aggies' part.
Think about, Keith, what would it be like if Delaware Valley played Thomas More at the top of this at the top of this event?
Yeah, well, certainly on from the PAC's point of view, you'd have to imagine it'd fare a little better. Thomas More, 15th ranked, got off to a much better start on Saturday than Washington Jefferson did. Beat Hanover 56-12, and you know, they've played pretty good defense the past couple of years. Been able to run the ball. Seems like the type of team that would match up well with Delaware Valley. But certainly, it didn't look good for the President's Athletic Conference on Saturday.
W&J is in a position, Keith, where we have rated them highly as a poll coming into the season for several years running. And now, you know, granted, the rating them highly at this point was number 20, which is maybe not a completely unreasonable position based on where they've been the last couple of years. But they've been... It's been a while since W&J has lived up to a ranking.
Yeah, you know, you go back a few years ago when they upset Millsaps in the playoffs. That was probably their best performance in the postseason. And you know, they got in last season, as we recall, and then lost 55-0 to Mountain Union. And it's hard to judge against the number one team in the country. But as we saw even on Saturday with Oshkosh going out, they're an unranked team. But from a powerful conference, you know, you can score points on Mountain Union. You can give Mountain Union a little bit of a challenge. It does seem like there could be a changing of the guard in the President's, in that Thomas More could begin to become the elite team on a consistent basis. But it has to happen, you know, for the number of years that Washington Jefferson has done it. And it's, you know, 10 to 15 years where they've been the class of that conference. You know, it's going to take a few years before we really write them off in any sort of way. And when we say write them off, we mean, you know, just as a consistent top 25 team.
Kudos to Bethany, which survived a last-minute field goal attempt by Kings to win 31-29. And Grove City, which beat Lebanon Valley 17-14, they were the PAC winners in the PAC-MAC challenge on Saturday. Keith, let's talk a little bit about what the games you saw this weekend. A couple of games first Friday night, SUNY Maritime at Western Connecticut, and then a really intriguing rivalry game on Saturday.
Yeah, the interesting thing at Western Connecticut State was just sort of the battle of small, shifty running backs with a lot of heart. And Maritime actually has a couple of guys that ran like that, and Felix Jean was one of them. And they were able to put that game away. On the flip side, Western Connecticut State, Tyler DeRosa hit 200 yards in that game. And so, you know, that was the good takeaway from that game. And now, you know, the Privateers also off to that 2-0 start. And now we start paying attention to them as a team in the ECFC, and this was a big win for that conference to beat a team from New Jersey. But I think on the flip side of that game, you know, it was clear that it was week one. You could sort of almost see some players, you know, they would break on the ball, they would see it, and they just weren't getting there fast enough. You're just a step slow. Some of the blocks, you know, not quite as crisp as they are later in the season, and that's sort of the case in week one and week two. And you start to see the quality of football improve late September, mid-October, where it really gets good. And that was one of my big takeaways from Friday. Saturday at Coast Guard, really getting a chance to see one of the great rivalries in Division III, and I was trying to think of a better word than great because it's not a battle of top 25 teams in Coast Guard and in Kings Point, or we you know they go by Merchant Marine and they call themselves Kings Point, but in terms of pomp and circumstance, in terms of what it means to the players and the alumni and the people at the game, you know, that's an atmosphere that compares with anything I've seen in my time doing around the nation. And it's not like anything else in Division III. You know, I was trying to compare it to something, you know, game day at St. John's in the middle of the fall against St. Thomas. It's got a great atmosphere, but it's not quite like this. Coast Guard rival, the Secretary's Cup, because it's got there's just sort of a, I guess the military aspect of it, you know, gives it a different aura than anything. You have the two groups of you know, cadets, midshipmen in the end zone going back and forth with each other, and then add into the fact that the game on Saturday was played on 9/11. September 11th, the ninth anniversary of that, not all that far from New York City, and there were certainly, you know, without being trite about it, there was certainly some you could feel that it mattered to people there, and you know, they did take some time at the end of the game to pay some respects to all the people from Coast Guard and from Merchant Marine Academy who are now out at sea, out serving. You know, one of the admirals spoke after the game and said, you know, we're rivals on the field, but we're partners at sea, and that sort of summed it up for me in the sense of just the way that rivalry was, real intense, and then a lot of respect after the game was over.
Yeah, I mean, Keith, when I've seen the rivalry, I've seen it I haven't seen the rivalry, I should say. I've been to games on both campuses with one set of cadets, and there's certainly, you know, a great deal of enthusiasm and a lot of a pomp and circumstance just for a regular home game for one of these two teams. You know, when I saw the cadets at Coast Guard a couple years ago, they were getting all fired up for a game against Worcester State. I can't imagine how that would compare to getting fired up for a season opener against your arch rival.
Yeah, there's that. There's this fact that it's a season opener, the fact that it's the rivalry game, and then the fact that they're more or less looking in the mirror across that bleacher section. There's a group that's just as rowdy as them on the other side that has a comeback. You know, there was a couple good back and forths where Coast Guard was taunting Merchant Marine about something that actually happened to SUNY Maritime, and so they would come up with a chant. And then they said that was the state school, you know, back to them. Or it was interesting that they had, you know, I actually kind of went in the crowd at one point. I was trying to find who starts the chants, and I should have looked harder because it would have been really interesting to see if they just start at random or if there is somebody designated that gets them going. And it was a lot of fun in those sections. And some points, you know, where it gets a little heated because they're just, you know, one break in the bleachers across from each other, and it's easy for one guy to jump off the bleachers and sort of run into the other side real quick, and it gets a little rowdy, and then everybody goes back to normal. And that was sort of a fun sideshow to the game itself, which was pretty exciting in the sense that started off, Coast Guard took the opening kick back 82 yards for a touchdown. Pat Bennett, fifth-year senior, a guy who a lot of his friends, guys he came in with, they're out serving right now, and those guys got in touch with him during the week and told him what the game meant to him. And I talked to him a little bit after the game, and he said, you know, what it meant to him to win this game and to have a big part in it. And he didn't just return the opening kickoff, but he, you know, made a big play on a safety blitz and did some other things in the game that were big plays. You know, what it meant to him to win it, not just for himself and for the younger cadets that were there, but guys that he played with and that were out serving. That was definitely interesting. And then the game itself, again, the opening kickoff.
It's right to Bennett at the 18-yard line off the foot of Richard Grannon. He cuts right past the 30, 40, 45, 50, finds a blocker, gets into Merchant Marine territory, and down the sideline, all the way for six. What a return for Pat Bennett. Yes, sir! Bears lead 6-0. What a way to start the season. Pat Bennett in for six from 81 yards out.
And then it started to look like that week one, week two type of game again, where teams would get rolling. A lot of passes, particularly on the Kings point side, just a little high, tipped off hands, intercepted by Coast Guard. Coast Guard would get rolling, come back, throw an interception, kind of, and going back and forth. There was a point in the game where after that opening kick, the score was 10-0, and then at one point it was 10-2. And there had been five interceptions combined, two missed field goals, or one missed, one blocked, and certainly a bunch of opportunities lost. Kings Point, late in the game, Merchant Marine had missed a shot, actually, with about 4 minutes left, perfect pass in the end zone, and just over the outstretched hands of the defensive back, and the receiver had it in his hands, and as he was falling down, he dropped it. And Merchant Marine, lucky enough to get the ball back, and drives down with 51 seconds left, throws a touchdown pass, similar place, and able to cut it to 10-8, and then they have to go for two. And if you can just imagine, any rivalry game that you've been to, it's all that and more. You know, they've now got a two-point conversion set up. The crowd, each team calls a timeout, you know, to build the suspense, and they run this play where the quarterback, he rolls out, and pressure comes, so he spins out of the pressure and he throws, and there's a receiver open in the back of the end zone, and you can see it from Merchant Marine. They're going to catch, they're going to tie it, and then Chris Isariana comes out of sort of nowhere, and he came off his man in the end zone and gets his hand on the pass, breaks it up, Coast Guard wins, and they sort of and actually had to get the onside kick before they could rush out on the field and enjoy the victory. But when you talk about what it meant to those players there, the atmosphere, the setting, you know, for that game to be right on the water there in New London, absolutely something you'll want to read about on Thursday when I get to it in Around the Nation. I didn't spoil everything, even though I did talk a long time about the experience. It was pretty fun.
Keith, are either of those plays, the long kickoff return or the broken up 2-point conversion, you think they're video play of the week candidates?
I think they should definitely be considered. Partially because of what it meant. You know, I think when we looked at those plays last week, they all stood on their own, but they also, you know, you kind of judge what it means in the context of the game. And for both of those plays, you know, that Kings Point pointed out to me after the game, he didn't give up a touchdown on defense and lost the game because the opening kick ended up being the big score for Coast Guard, so that certainly meant a lot. And then that end zone play, anytime you got one play to tie the game or to win the game, and that happens, you know, on every Saturday across the country, maybe a dozen times in a dozen different places, but it's certainly something that people out there, if you're listening, get on your SIDs and the people in your athletic department to get that video to us, because I think it's going to be a great feature to see every week the most unique plays that happen across the country, the things that you know whether it's a tip ball or something crazy that you've never seen before, or those game ending type of plays where the whole game rides on this one play, and to be able to be, you know, whether you're based on the East Coast or in the Midwest or way out west or in Texas, and to see all the plays from across the country and get a feel for what it's like to be at that game on that Saturday, that's going to be something really unique.
I did hear from one reader this week who just liked getting a chance to look at all the various stadiums on the four clips that we did post and see what the campuses are like. And before we leave the Coast Guard Merchant Marine game, I just thought I'd throw out a little recognition to former colleagues of ours and former D3Football.com team members who call games for those teams, Mark Simon at Coast Guard, and then Ray Martell and Seth Cantor for Merchant Marine, and I hope they treated you well. Another game that was, you know, not at all related, so the heck with the transition. Let's talk about the St. John's Wisconsin Eau Claire game last night, Keith. I'm trying to listen to this game as I'm driving across central Wisconsin, and they must be on one of those AM stations that has to power down at night, because I can only listen to about 20 minutes of it, and I had to have my brothers put the phone by the computer so I could listen to the rest of the game, because I never gotten within range of the St. John's broadcast either. But in the end, Keith, it's almost like you just have to expect this from St. John's and Wisconsin Eau Claire every year. They play on a very regular basis. it's always a battle no matter where either one of these teams ends up nationally or within the scheme of their conference. And in this case, it was Eau Claire coming up with the win at home in overtime.
Yeah, and not only was it a win in overtime, but that the dramatic last 5 minutes of that game, you know, for a good portion of that game, St. John's led 10-3. And if you're able to read Frank Rakowski's game story on in the St. Cloud Times about this game, he described it as sort of it was building toward you know, St. John's was leading, but it felt like they weren't leading. And then all of a sudden, Eau Claire scores with 4:52 left. They score again with 2:04 left to take that 17-10 lead. And then St. John's scores with 6 seconds left to put it into overtime. And then are able to Eau Claire is able to win it in overtime. So it certainly must have been exciting, whether you were listening or getting it piped to you through the phone. You know, the game goes into overtime at tied at 17. St. John's kicks a 40-yard field goal, you know, basically gains no yardage on their possession. And then Eau Claire, it caps it off with the Joel Sweeney touchdown run to win at 23-20. And as you mentioned, Pat, put it into the sort of the pantheon of great games between these two teams.
Keith, in basketball, there's a cliche, and you know how I hate cliches, but I'm just going to throw this out there. The thing where you go for the tie at home and you go for the win on the road. The St. John's with that touchdown with 6 seconds left in regulation had the opportunity to put a two-point conversion team out there and try to win the game in regulation rather than go for the one and go for the tie. What do you think about that in football?
I'm not so much home road as it's sort of a coach's judgment how he feels his team is playing. If St. John's felt, as Frank Rakowski described it, they were ahead the whole game and were sort of not lucky, but were fortunate, you know, to not be down in that, at that point in the game and came back and scored. If they felt like, hey, we're not going to outplay them in overtime, then yeah, I think you maybe go for two. But I don't have any problem with a coach saying, hey, we just put together this 81-yard 10-play drive, score with 6 seconds left. We've got the momentum. Let's kick the point. And they were fortunate enough, too. They got the ball first in overtime, which a lot of times you want to go on defense because you that way you know what you need to do. But sometimes if you're coming off the momentum of this 81-yard drive, you want the ball right away and feel like maybe you can just turn it into another quick touchdown and then put the pressure on Eau Claire. And that's not how it happened. But I think it's a sound decision if the Johnny's coaching staff felt like they were the better team going into overtime.
For St. John's, you mentioned the drive that gets them the score at the end of regulation. They hadn't had a whole lot of success on offense, especially the, you know, second and third quarter there down the stretch. St. John's did have one other drive earlier in the day, which was a 17-play, 73-yard drive back in the first quarter that ended with a fumble. It's just St. John's struggled on offense, and, you know, you can't learn anything really from playing Northwestern last week. So you really, if you throw that game out, you're now left with two really puzzling performances for them in a row. The home loss to Co., which was a top seed against probably the sixth seed, in last year's West bracket, and then losing this game on the road on Saturday.
Yeah, and you mentioned it. It's hard to know what to make of St. John's. They're another team, not quite in that Washington-Jefferson thing that we mentioned earlier, but consistently ranked high, and certainly has been deserving of it. You know, there's years where they're championship caliber. And then there's years where you don't quite know early in the season what you're going to get from St. John's, you know, partially because they always play Eau Claire and Eau Claire gives them a pretty good test. Sometimes they, you know, they'll lose a game early in the MIAC schedule, or they play Bethel early and it ends up being a tough game. And you don't get a real good feel for what kind of St. John's team it's going to be until later on in the season. And, you know, looking at the numbers, nothing really, really jumps out. You know, Joe Boyle, only passing for 138 yards, but you know, he was the only quarterback that played, so they don't have any kind of dilemma there. You know, no rushing numbers that stand out, no receiving numbers that stand out defensively. Probably a pretty good day up until that fourth quarter, you know, up until the last 5 minutes. You know, maybe this is a St. John's team that will have a defense carry it. You know, it's just hard to tell from not having been there at that game.
I'll get a chance to see them against St. Thomas on October 2nd. St. John's has to regroup and host Concordia Moorhead next Saturday. For Mary Harden Baylor, it was a slow start on Saturday, and it almost ended up costing them. They give up the first 19 points to Wisconsin Lacrosse.
That is a game that was going to be another one of these ones that shook up the whole top 25 if Lacrosse was able to hang on and just kind of go down what the WIAC did on Saturday. Playing number 9 St. John's, number 6 Mary Harden Baylor, number 2 Mount Union, and this wasn't Whitewater playing those teams. These are just the middle teams, you know, the fairly decent teams in the conference, you know, playing some of the toughest teams in the country and hanging with them in most cases. You know, in Eau Claire's case they won the game, but gave Mary Harden Baylor quite a test, quite a scare with that 19-0 lead. The Crusaders were able to pull it out and win 24-19. Finished with 389 yards of offense, which is, 242 of those are rushing, which is kind of, for them, slightly above average. You know, that's a team that loves to get to run the ball and sort of shove it down the other team's throat. And, you know, 242 for some teams is a great day rushing. For Mary Harden Baylor, you know, it's a decent day, and it certainly didn't start out very well.
We talk about the what we've learned so far and in shaking up the top 25, which this game almost could have done. And, you know, who knows, it may make some teams or some voters think twice about where they have Mary Harden Baylor. But how much of this is, to go back to the Mountain Union Oshkosh thing, is the fact that it's Mary Harden Baylor's opener and it's Lacrosse's second game, and Mary Harden Baylor's, you know, going halfway across the country to get there, basically.
You know, those type of things can be factors, and especially if you have a young team or if you let it be a factor. You know, I talked to one coach this week who was telling me, and this is how I was as a player, I like those road games because you go, you get away from everything, you get in, it's just you and the team at the hotel, and you're focused on football. You know, you might go out to eat or go to a movie or something, and then you're back at the hotel. You know, maybe you have a meeting at night, you're up for the game, and, you know, everything is focused on that game. So sometimes those road games, you know, people say it's a home field advantage, but it can be almost an advantage in some ways for the road team because they don't have the distractions of, you know, my family's coming in the night before and all that stuff. But when you get between the white lines, you know, how much does it mean? You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, unless you're jet lagged or something like that, it may not have that much of an impact on the game itself. The thing for Mary Harden Baylor, as you mentioned, it being their first game, maybe some of that 19-0 deficit had to do with them just having those first game jitters, not being very sharp, and then sort of building up over the course of the game where they finally started being themselves. And sometimes that urgency doesn't kick in until you get down. You know, and you hope it's not 19-0 before your team really gets it together. But in Mary Harden Baylor's case, fortunate they were able to get it together.
They did score the last 24 points and came away with a 24-19 victory on the road on Saturday. That was just one of a handful of games, high-level games, as you mentioned, involving the WIAC. But also, you know, between Hardin-Simmons and Willamette the first 2 weeks, they've really kind of reached out and touched a couple other conferences as well, and now we have some interesting bases. We have an interesting basis for comparison between like the WIAC and the American Southwest Conference and the Northwest Conference as well.
Yeah, because top two teams now in the AAC, or the traditionally the top two teams, Hardin-Simmons and Mary Harden Baylor, now have played. You got a WIAC direct game, and then you have that Hardin-Simmons Willamette Stevens Point triangle. If Hardin-Simmons is better than Willamette is better than Stevens Point, and Stevens Point ends up being, you know, the second team in the WIAC, then that'll give us a good comparison to how strong they are. But I think, you know, one of the big winners in all this really is the WIAC, actually, because their middle teams, upper half, but not Whitewater, they're playing some of the best teams in the country and coming away looking good. Hardin-Simmons certainly comes away looking good. They have and they do this themselves very frequently, but kind of a murderous early schedule. A trip halfway across the country to Whitworth, they win that one 27-7. Then able to figure out the fly offense a little bit. They actually got passed on for quite a few yards, but were able to limit Willamette's rushing offense and win 31-22 at home. Then last season's American Southwest champions come to Abilene next week in Mississippi College, and then that big Mary Harden Baylor game, they'll go to Belton on the 25th. So just in the month of September, you have Harden Simmons playing three teams, you know, that probably, if not top 25, you know, top 50 teams. You know, we can go back through kickoff and see where we had Whitworth, but Willamette, Mississippi College, Mary Harden Baylor, certainly four teams to start off with. That if Harden Simmons can keep this going, now them being 2-0, and if they get through that stretch 4-0, they're going to be one of the teams we focus on for quite some time.
Yeah, three of those opponents have been in the playoffs just in the last 2 years, and Whitworth has been in the playoffs in the past. You mentioned that the WIAC's one of the big winners out of that grouping. Keith, I think the Division III football fan in general is a big winner out of those games scheduled early on in the season.
Yeah, you have to love some of the non-conference games we've been lucky enough to see these first 2 weeks. You know, whether it's the Cal Lutheran in Linfield, you know, Eau Claire, St. John's, Harden Simmons and Willamette, and Mary Harden Baylor at La Crosse. Those are all, you know, those are some of Week 2's biggest games, but they're all top teams from top conferences, you know, clashing against each other. And, you know, we couldn't be everywhere, and we sort of would love to watch all those games, to be honest with you. This would have been one of those weekends where, you know, if there were D3 television coverage from wall to wall, you would be watching games back and forth, or you'd be taping one on one channel or on the upstairs TV, and you'd be watching one downstairs, or you'd be at a game and DVRing a game, because there's so. I mean, I would have loved to see Harden Simmons, you know, play against Willamette, and to see this Willamette have a game where they have a receiver, 8 catches for 222 yards and 3 touchdowns from a team that's primarily known for the way it runs the ball. You know, that's something that you want to see and not just read about.
And if you couldn't see it, and you were at another game, it was a good week to be on Twitter. Let's put it that way. There was a lot of stuff, a lot of updates flying back and forth. Almost everything except for, say, Cal Lutheran Linfield, which happened while I was driving back from Oshkosh, and I didn't have anything to retweet. I try not to type whole brand new tweets on the phone while driving. And the state of Minnesota would not let me even think about it. Yeah, exactly. But if you send something, I can retweet it while I'm driving. Otherwise, you know, sometimes we're just limited by the fact that there's only a couple of people actually working on the site at a time.
Yeah. But if you're just on there, you know, for me yesterday, I'm on there working, you know, tweeting stuff from my game and retweeting things that I see. But also you're on there, you know, if you're giving, I'm also on there taking, and I'm seeing these updates come in from across the country, and it's certainly a place to be on Saturday. You know, if you're only going to be able to be in one place, but if you have a phone with you, or if you have a computer, if you happen to be at home, and you can, you know, you can sort of keep track of everything. It is kind of that experience that we talked about, whether it's not television flipping back and forth, but you get the updates, and it gets crazy. It's like that first week of the playoffs where all those games are running at the same time. And you kind of care about all of them. It was like that yesterday, you know, to see the updates and to see four minutes left, you know, 10-3 in this game, or for, you know, they're driving and it's 2 points, and it goes on into the night. Actually, you know, we were getting the Guilford Methodist updates and the St. John's. You know, like I said, you were following that best you could. It's fun. I mean, it just makes for Saturday to be real exciting. And if you love college football, if you love Division III football, you know, it's worth your time to be on Twitter and to be sending us stuff as you're getting stuff from us. It really is exciting.
We're already over the 40-minute mark of this podcast, so we're going to go lightning round down the rest of the rundown here. Imagine, if you would, a rundown of games on the left-hand side of your screen. I don't know where that thought might have come from. But some other interesting games from Saturday. Huntington 62, Louisiana College 56 in overtime.
Yeah, we were concerned about that offense without Justin Ridgeway, but 54 points in week one and 62 looked pretty good so far.
Yeah, the 54 in week one, even if, you know, you discount the fact that Maryville lost its quarterback shortly before that game and, you know, wasn't able to put up much of a fight, but still 62 points in week two kind of validates 54 in week one. Another game also in that part of the country, LaGrange beating Millsaps 27-21 in overtime.
And now that's two losses to start the season for Millsaps under a new coaching staff, sort of the opposite of what we've talked about for Grinnell and some of those other schools that have gotten off to a good start. Don't know what to make of Millsaps because it's a team that generally has as much talent as the best teams in the SCAC, so we'll have to see if they can rebound.
Millsaps losing the first game at home to Mississippi College, a very talented team. That's one thing, and then going on the road and losing to LaGrange, which had lost quite a few players from its good years, that's a bit of a different story. And with Millsaps, that's a team that's changed quarterbacks now twice in the past 2 years after graduating a top-flight starter. Another game, Hampton-Sydney 21, North Carolina Wesleyan 19.
Better showing for the USA South than in week one, but Hampton-Sydney struggle a little bit. The Averett game, the score looked closer than it was. This one, maybe a little bit more of an impressive win for them, but maybe kind of what we predicted in kickoff to Hampton-Sydney, not quite as dominant as they were when they went 10-0 last season.
RPI strong in middle relief, and then the closer comes in to shut the door as they beat Endicott 6-3.
Yeah, Endicott was one of those teams that I thought would be pretty good out of the NFC void, but RPI, you now start to have to wonder, are they going to be a factor in the Liberty League? You know, Liberty League loses its champion to Centennial, so that it's going to be wide open, but maybe it's just going to be Union and Hobart, just like old times.
Your alma mater, Keith, defeating Johns Hopkins 41-37. That's Randolph-Macon, by the way, I should say that.
You mentioned in a different case a team that won impressively in week one and then gets a better quality opponent in week two, Randolph-Macon beating 19th-ranked Johns Hopkins 41-37. And it looks like the Yellow Jacket offense is pretty legitimate, too. Same case as with Huntington, 54 points against Methodist in week one, 41 on Saturday, and then scoring and winning that game in dramatic fashion, scoring a touchdown with 33 seconds left.
Johns Hopkins had the great playoff run last year, parlayed that into a pretty high position in the poll coming into the season, and then by virtue of a week one bye, kind of drifted its way up four spots while some other teams fell or were less than impressive, and now things will correct a little bit there. How about Baldwin Wallace beating Capital 10-7?
You never know who that second team is going to be in the OAC, and with Capital losing an early one, Baldwin Wallace has been that team in previous years, but it's been a few years since it's been Baldwin Wallace, and now you wonder if they start to creep back in the discussion, or is it Otterbein, is it John Carroll? That you just don't know which team besides Mount Union that you have to watch. So that's a significant result in the early going that may point us in the right direction.
Baldwin Wallace with a Division II transfer, a quarterback. Maybe we didn't learn so much about how they did against Worcester in week one, but a win against Capital is certainly a different story. How about University of Chicago crushing Concordia Chicago 56-24? Keith, I think we picked the Concordia, Illinois, River Forest, Chicago, whatever you want to call them, to go undefeated, and they certainly had almost everybody back from last year's 8-2 team.
Yeah, and that's one of those stunners that kind of comes out of nowhere early in the season, and that happens across the country, but It was not the loss, but the fashion in which it happened. Chicago, 21-7 first quarter, 21-10 second quarter, so they had 42 points in the first half on the way to that 56-24 win. And there's a block punt in there, but other than that, it was all offense for Chicago. And to see that coming from a UAA team is certainly surprising and eye opening. And for Concordia Chicago, or Concordia Illinois, as we like to call them on the site, certainly. Just makes us go back to the drawing board on what we think of them. Now, are they going to be able to compete for their conference? And do you get your confidence back after you lose a 56-24 game?
A couple of other games, Ursinus beating Franklin and Marshall 10-7. That's I don't know if it's an elimination game in the Centennial necessarily, but certainly puts Ursinus off on the right foot, and we picked them to go undefeated in kickoff. Cortland State defeated Kane 24-12, or the other lightning round games. And then games coming up next week as we're, wow, we're coming up on the 50-minute mark. Thanks for sticking with us here on our Week 3 podcast. We're getting forward to Ohio Northern and Otterbein, speaking of elimination games. It's a game to decide who could be the challenger to Mountain Union in the OAC and possibly get an at-large bid. We mentioned earlier St. John's hosting Concordia Moorhead. Delaware Valley against Wesley, that's a battle of top 10 teams that Gordon Mann will be at for D3Football.com and you know, for other things. We have Dubuque at Central. We got Mississippi College at Hardin-Simmons mentioned earlier. Rowan Montclair, that'll be a good game in the New Jersey Athletic Conference. DePauw playing center. And Ripon Grinnell, which is a game that wouldn't have been on the radar a couple weeks ago, but it is now. So for Keith McMillan, I'm Pat Coleman, saying so long for the Around the Nation podcast. And stick back and come back the rest of the week, because we keep adding things to the weekly rundown. Statistical Spotlight on Monday. We're going to do the Play of the Week on Tuesday morning, so get your nominations and your videos in now. Around the region and then Around the Nation as we head back into week 3 of action coming up this weekend.